Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Adam Vingan from The Athletic taking you through this Wednesday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's been a busy time for the Titans in free agency. Maybe not done yet in free agency. We'll have to see as the days continue to unfold here. Let's bring on our good friend John Glennon from The Athletic. John, what's going on, my man?
Not too much, Smash Brothers. How are you?
We're hanging in
there.
Doing
great. Are you finding a way, John, to remain in soccer-playing shape while we're all going through this coronavirus situation together?
I am doing my best. We do out here in Bellevue have obviously the big Edwin Warner Park near us, so I can still do my running from time to time. However, it's getting a little bit crowded. A lot of people having the same idea, so we're having to make sure we keep our good social distancing nonetheless.
Are you practicing your slide tackling on the rug at home?
Yes, I've been knocking the cat out a few times. He's very troubled by what's going on, but these times are desperate measures, right?
Yes.
Well, John, obviously the Titans freed up a lot of money when they sent Jarrell Casey to the Denver Broncos in exchange for a 7th-round pick, and naturally people have tried to connect the dots between the Titans and Jadeveon Clowney since then, and it remains to be seen whether or not that's going to happen with the Titans. But I think when you take a look at what's going on right now with the Titans, how would you approach the draft if you're John Robinson, given that Conklin is gone? You don't know exactly right now what's going to happen with the pass rush situation. And I think regardless of whether or not Logan Ryan comes back, you're going to have to address the cornerback position at some point. How would you approach the draft if you're the Titans?
Yeah, in terms of priorities, I mean, whereas previously you might have thought edge rusher, was your number one priority, given the problems with pressure on the quarterback last year. They have added Vic Beasley, who has a decent reputation for getting after the quarterback. So I don't think you're as desperate in that situation now as you might have been before. I just did my second mock draft for the Titans today, and my first rounder was actually a tackle. I'm sure people obviously are saying, hey, wait a minute, didn't they sign Dennis Kelly? Isn't he going to be the new right tackle? Well, yes, but I don't know if he's the long-term guy there. He's already 30 years old, and he's been basically a swing guy for most of his career. So I kind of like the idea that there's a ton of tackles, good tackles in this year's draft, and why not take advantage of that? It's kind of rare that you see a lot of tackles these days, so I had him going tackle in the first round, probably second round. You got to fill that hole that Jarrell Casey left when he was traded. So I kind of went there, number two. And then three is definitely jumping into that cornerback situation, especially if Logan Ryan chooses or finds a different home. I think you've obviously got to find a little bit cornerback help right there. So those are my top three picks as of today. That may well change in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. We'll see. But there's plenty of time for more mock drafts and more waffling on my part.
John, if you're the Titans, what number would you be comfortable offering Logan Ryan for him to come back with the Titans? And how much of a priority do you think it should be for John Robinson to try to bring Logan Ryan back?
Well, Logan Ryan was very valuable to this team. I mean, the numbers that he racked up in a lot of different categories were so impressive. I mean, interceptions, forced fumbles, sacks, tackles. He filled a lot of different roles and, had, in many respects, his best season. I'm still not sure that he is, kind of an elite pass defender at this point. I think he's very good. But, do you pay a guy 29 years old who is not, a speed merchant, shall we say? I'm not saying he's slow, but, speed is not his strength. Do you go $10 million for a guy like Logan Ryan, which is reportedly what he is asking for, at least $10 million, which is what he averaged the last 3 years on his contract with the Titans? Well, you know, I'm not so sure. You know, at this point in free agency, you know, and many people have said this, if you're not already gone, you're probably not going to get what you're asking for at this point. So, I don't think the Titans, in my mind, would be willing to go to $10 million. My guess, and this is just the speculation, you know, maybe more around $8 million or so for a Logan Ryan. You know, in one respect, I'm sure they'd love to have him back. In another respect, you know, maybe you'd like to bring some more speed to that position too. And you know, maybe you look to the draft in that regard.
John Glennon, my colleague at The Athletic, joins us here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. John, earlier you referenced the Titans mock draft 2.0 that you currently have up on theathletic.com. You talked about taking a tackle in the first round. Specifically, which tackle did you pinpoint and why?
I like big Josh Jones out of Houston, Adam. There are going to be some excellent tackles that are going to be off the board by the time the Titans get around. But I like Josh Jones because of a few different things. Good foot movement. You know, he's a very, very big guy, but he's still light on his feet. He's become much better in run blocking, which, of course, is important to the Titans, you know, with the offense that they run and Derrick Henry coming back. Excellent pass protector because he's been in a University of Houston system that passes the ball a lot and gave up very little in terms of pass pressure over the years. Maybe one knock, if you will, on Josh Jones is that maybe he's still a little bit raw, you know, so that gives you a ceiling. I think he's going to be even better in another year or so, but he'll have that time to grow because Dennis Kelly is probably going to be the starter, if not for the entire year, certainly for the bulk of this year. So they have that freedom to let Josh Jones grow a little bit more. And, you know, eventually I think he would become that right tackle of the future.
John, I'm really interested in the leadership void that has been created this offseason by the Tennessee Titans. Of course, letting go of Marcus Mariota, trading Jarrell Casey. Even if you look back to last year with Brian Arakpo retiring, a lot of the longtime leaders of this group are no longer there. So when you think of the dressing room or the locker room for the Tennessee Titans, which player or players do you think needs to step up the most in order to fill that void?
Well, we know that a couple of guys that are going to be returning are returning captains. So guys like Kevin Byard on defense and Ben Jones, I think, you know, naturally players are going to be looking to them. You know, Ryan Tannehill, I'm sure coming into the year as a starter, will take even more of a leadership role. We remember last year how he said he sort of had to kind of dial back at the start of the year because at that point it was Marcus's team and, you know, he didn't want to intrude on that. So I'm sure he'll play a bigger part. We've seen Derrick Henry grow in terms of his leadership over the years. You know, I think more vocal and just by what Derrick Henry is doing on the field, people naturally take whatever he says, whatever he does very seriously. So I think that's a big one. Even a guy like a Roger Saffold, you know, who's been in the league 10, 11 years, I think is going to have to step up. And then, you know, maybe flipping back on the defense again. Some of the younger guys, like a Rashawn Evans, you know, be his third year in the league. I think he's got some good leadership potential. Jayon Brown and Kenny Vaccaro, too. You know, that's a two guys, when you look at Byard and Vaccaro back there at the safety spot, I think those are two guys with a lot of leadership capability. And that's good, especially, I think, from the safety positions. They're setting a lot of those guys on defense.
John Glennon from The Athletic on the line with us. And, John, Marcus Mariota lands with the Las Vegas Raiders. Two-year deal, $17.6 million. That also includes a ton of incentives. I think the max value of the contract can get up to $37.5 million. What did you make of the contract that Mariota received, and what do you make of his fit with John Gruden in Las Vegas?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, the fit, I think, is a good one. You know, you look back at some of those tapes from when Marcus was coming out in college for the draft, and both John Gruden and Mike Mayock were very high on Marcus Mariota. You know, talked him up quite a bit, obviously, that the two were not together at that time, but both on their own were very – Mayock, you know, he was Mayock's top quarterback over Jameis Winston, and John Gruden just seemed to kind of fall in love with Marcus Mariota when they did those quarterback sort of tutorial specials there. So I think he's comfortable in that regard. I think the contract is probably in a lot of ways similar to what Ryan Tannehill had here with the Titans. The understanding right now and the expectation coming in is that he's number two, but there's still a very real chance that he could end up as number one, whether that's through injury or whether that's through poor play by Derek Carr. And if he does end up as a starter, he's going to be able to learn or earn a lot of incentive money, just as Ryan Tannehill did. But, you know, I think Marcus did a radio interview from a radio station in Hawaii the other day, and, you know, some of his comments were a little bit telling. I think he said his first priority was finding a place that had kind of coaching and front office stability and security in his mind. And that maybe is as close as Marcus Mariota ever gets to criticizing anything, you know. And you can understand, you know, here's a guy who went through two general managers, you know, three head coaches, five play callers during his time in Tennessee. And I'm sure that impacted Marcus Mariota's performance. So, you know, those are two things he looks for. And it sounds like he's a very, very happy guy right now. And we all hope so for Marcus. You know, no one can say a bad word about him. So it seems like a good fit for him.
John, I'm curious how you think Marcus will take to Las Vegas as a city, because I can just imagine him, you know, hitting up the casinos, playing some 21, some roulette. How do you think Marcus, you know, Nashville and Las Vegas have their similarities, but what do you think about Marcus Mariota in Las Vegas as a city?
Soon we'll be hearing those stories of Marcus running wild up and down the strip, and, you know, having a harem of women around him. And I don't think we'll see that anytime soon. I think, you know, Marcus is just such a homebody that it really doesn't matter where he is, whether it's Nashville or Vegas or any place else. He's going to find kind of his comfort zone. And I think he's just a homebody. You know, maybe in his mind, I pure speculation, maybe he's about the time where he's going to start settling down like you youngsters have done recently as well. I just don't think it matters that there will be all these temptations out there, because Marcus is not a man who's going to avail himself of these temptations. So don't look for a lot of TMZ headlines out of Marcus in Las Vegas.
John Glennon from The Athletic has been our guest here on Morning Drive. John, thanks so much for joining us as always, and good luck in your pursuit of remaining in soccer playing shape through this crisis. We appreciate you.
All right. Thank you, Smash Brothers.
Thanks, John.
All righty. When we come back here on Morning Drive, we'll talk about the fit of Marcus Mariota with the Las Vegas Raiders. Does he have a chance to become the starting quarterback at some point this upcoming season? We'll get into that next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Adam Vindgen here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Are you working from home during the COVID-19 pandemic? Stream us from anywhere. Download the Game Nashville app, enable our Alexa skill or Google Home, and ask to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, thegamenashville.com. Welcome back into Morning Drive. Robbie Stanley alongside Adam Vindgen from The Athletic taking you this Wednesday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. And Adam, we had John Glennon on in the last segment, and we were talking about the fit between Marcus Mariota and the Las Vegas Raiders. And it's interesting because I think you look around the league, and obviously since then Chicago has decided to go in a different direction. They brought in Nick Foles via trade with the Jacksonville Jaguars to be, I guess, what we would assume the backup quarterback to start the season behind Mitch Trubisky. Feeling pretty good that that's going to change at some point with the Chicago Bears. But I think if you're Mariota, you know, Joe and I have talked about the Chicago Bears were a very interesting team from the standpoint of, if you're looking for a situation that, you know, could do pretty similarly to what happened to you last year with Tannehill coming in and taking Mariota's job, if you're looking to do that to someone else, I think Chicago would have been the perfect scenario for Marcus Mariota. Obviously didn't work out there. He signs with the Raiders. And Derek Carr, I mean, you look at it, and Mariota's, this is Derek Carr's team. Mariota from a perspective is going to come in. He's going to do his job. He's not going to cause any problems whatsoever. But I do think there's at least a chance that Mariota's going to come in there and at some point could be the starting quarterback for the Raiders. And I think his contract kind of illustrates that. I mean, I talked about the two-year $17.6 million deal that he signed, $7.5 million of which is fully guaranteed as his base salary in the first year. The incentives in the contract, and a lot of them based on playing time and what he could do from that standpoint, they could get all the way up to $37.5 million if he achieves all of those incentives over the life of the contract. So I think that tells you right there that the Raiders are at least entertaining the idea that at some point during this stretch, Mariota could be their guy under center.
Yeah, and I found this tweet from Mike Garofalo of the NFL Network, I believe. Yes, he says, quote, Mariota gets up to $2.4 million if he plays 60% of the snaps in 2020. Another $1.5 million is available in per-game playing time and win incentives. Has $10 million in those incentives available in 2021. Also, $2 million in playoff/Super Bowl incentives each year and $12 million in 2021 salary escalator. So if I'm Marcus Mariota, the way that your career ended with the Tennessee Titans wasn't great by any means. But you had a good learning experience with what happened last year, where you learned what happens when a team brings in a veteran quarterback that can push you for playing time. And if you don't play well, you're going to end up on the bench. And that's what happened to Marcus, of course. And now he can take that lesson and apply it to what he's dealing with now, where he's assuming the role of Ryan Tannehill and Derek Carr is playing Marcus. So I do think that while I'm sure Marcus wished that his career with the Tennessee Titans would have ended differently or that he would still be with the team, at least now he has that experience of knowing, okay, I went through this last year from the opposite perspective. I know what it's going to take in order to earn this coach's, John Gruden's trust and potentially start for this team at some point during the season. So I do think, if you're looking for the glass half full view of it from Marcus Mariota's aspect, I think that's one thing he can lean on.
And obviously it's no secret that Gruden really likes Marcus Mariota. Mike Mayock, the general manager of the Raiders, I think really liked Mariota when he was coming out in the draft as well. Munson, you're a guy that obviously follows the Raiders very closely. What do you think the relationship is like between Derek Carr and John Gruden at this point?
I mean, obviously, this is a business, man. You're going to bring in guys who, quite frank, I mean, it's a better backup than having, Mike Glennon as your backup quarterback, than having Marcus Mariota. So I think Derek Carr understands that this is a business. It's kind of how he got the job, getting drafted in the second round and then fighting for a starting spot, and then he ended up getting it his rookie year. So he understands the situation. Like, he had one of his best seasons last year when it comes to stats, but when it came to the other things, like touchdowns, only had 21 last year. 8 interceptions, didn't throw the ball to the other team a lot like Jameis Winston, but he didn't also throw it in the end zone a lot either with 21 touchdowns. So I think their relationship is more so John Gruden is going to want his guy. He's going to want a guy that he wants to build as the quarterback, and I just don't think he sees Derek Carr as that guy that's going to take him over that next step. That's why every time we go into the draft, he's always intrigued by Kyler Murray's. I'm pretty sure he's intrigued by Tua. I'm pretty sure he loves some Tua and some Joe Burrow, but he just can't get them. So I just think he wants to go – he wants his fate to be decided in a quarterback that he wants to develop, and I don't think Derek Carr's that guy.
What about Nathan Peterman?
No, definitely not.
Mike Glennon?
Mike Glennon and him were awful, awful, awful.
Indeed.
Munson is still scarred from the ghost of Nathan Peterman, which I am as well as a Tennessee fan watching him play at Tennessee. Adam, it is kind of interesting, like when you look at what happened to Mariota last year with Tannehill coming in, and you just naturally, I think if you're a Titans fan or if you follow the Titans for any length of time, you ask yourself, okay, could Mariota go somewhere else and do that and become a successful starting quarterback in the NFL elsewhere? And look, I'll be honest with you, this time last year, you know, was I having a conversation about Ryan Tannehill maybe coming in and running and being the guy for the Titans long term? No. I mean, I don't think anybody was. But we all saw what happened. He came in and looked like a totally different player here in Nashville than he did with the Miami Dolphins, which I think kind of proved that sometimes it is as simple as just a change of scenery. I don't know what you guys think, but I really don't have that much confidence that Mariota's going to do that elsewhere. I'm not saying he can't be a useful player in the NFL, but you know, just from some of the limitations we saw from his time here in Nashville, I think those are limitations that are going to be there anywhere, regardless of what system he is running. So I don't really envision Mariota going to the Raiders and just lighting it up and then being the long-term answer at quarterback like Tannehill has become here with the Titans.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think you're wrong to believe that. I look at Derek Carr as I think Derek Carr is a solid fantasy quarterback. And what I mean by that is, if you know, he was my backup on my fantasy team last year, you can count on him having plenty of yards, plenty of touchdowns, maybe a lot of it in garbage time, but you can count on him, you know, picking up statistics. But, you know, for the most part, Derek Carr has not gotten the Las Vegas, when they were the Oakland Raiders. He did not get the Oakland Raiders and might not get the Las Vegas Raiders to where they want to go. And you mentioned the infatuation that Gruden and Mayock seemingly had with Marcus Mariota in 2015. You know, perhaps that plays into it as well. You know, perhaps those feelings bubble back up to the surface, and both of them are intrigued by what might be with Marcus Mariota. So I think you have to take that into account as well. But you know, I think Derek Carr is a good quarterback, and he barely misses games. I think the day that he broke his leg, which I think was the same day that Marcus broke his leg a few seasons ago, is the only game he's missed, or one of the few games that he's missed. But you know, if the Raiders get off to a slow start under Derek Carr, I would not be surprised to see Marcus at some point under center for the Raiders. I will defer to Marquise as someone who watches the Raiders on a regular basis.
Do you think
that's within the realm of possibility, though, just based on what you know of Derek Carr as a quarterback and what the team has looked like with him under center?
I think Derek Carr is, when he's had weapons, when he had an Amari Cooper, which obviously they traded that away,
yes,
and when he had a Michael Crabtree, and when he had weapons surrounding him, he was a good quarterback. Now, I think the playoff, when the Raiders made the playoffs last, I think this was 2016. When he got hurt, he was playing some of his best football. At that point, he was even in discussions for MVP. Not going to win it, but he was in discussions around that. So I just don't think there's that much of a drop off from that Derek Carr we saw in 2016 from the Derek Carr we see now, minus the people that he has around him. The offensive line has gotten weaker since then. The wide receivers have gotten weaker since then. So I think if they use their first round pick to get a guy like Jerry Jeudy or CD Lamb, or whoever, you know, T. Higgins, or whoever in the first round, I think he can get back to that Derek Carr that we've seen in 2016. Now, it's also added that he has added pressure, knowing that a guy's breathing down his neck trying to take his job. So it makes it a lot easier to get back to that 2016 Derek Carr, knowing that you got a guy like that behind you that can easily just step in and take your job. So I think it's going to be a lot different than when Mariota lost his job to Ryan Tannehill. I think it's going to be a lot different.
When we come back, Greg Wyshynski from ESPN covers the NHL for ESPN.com will join us. We'll get into some news that came out from the NHL yesterday regarding the self-quarantine period. Also get his thoughts on the Norris Trophy battle between Roman Josi and John Carlson. That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Adam Vingan here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Adam Vingan from The Athletic taking you through this Wednesday morning in Nashville, Tennessee, and it's our good friend again, Greg Wyshynski, joining us, ESPN senior NHL writer. Greg, what's going on, my man?
Not much, boys. Hope everybody is doing well and is healthy and keeping it together out there.
Hope you're doing the same. And Greg, obviously yesterday the NHL came out and it was revealed that they instructed their players and team staff to extend their period of self-quarantine by another 10 days through, I believe, at least April 6th. Not a huge surprise there, and probably not going to be a surprise at all that to extend it beyond that as well, I would think.
Yeah, and keep in mind, you know, the self-quarantine thing is different than the overall season pause. The self-quarantine thing is more of a medical suggestion just to see if anybody's symptoms manifest. It does take a while sometimes for symptoms to manifest. We're still talking about players that, you know, like many of these, a couple of these Ottawa Senators that came down with coronavirus were playing in California a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it does take a while for these things to come around. So it's more of a preventative and, you know, let's see what we've got here type measure. But the overall thing remains that the NHL is going to abide by the CDC guidelines, which said that you know, basically 8 weeks from the season pause was when they were going to start to maybe think about even maybe coming back and playing a season, which, I mean, I think we all kind of agree that they're going to have to extend it again. But that's the bigger picture right now. This is more of a, you know, let's make sure these guys are safe and let's, you know, see if any of them come down with symptoms.
Greg, a few days ago, the CHL, which includes the Western League, the Ontario League, and the Quebec League, made the decision to cancel the remainder of their season. This morning, the KHL decided to cancel what remained of their season, including the postseason. Do you think those decisions will have any sort of influence on the NHL's thinking as they decide what to do with their season?
No, because the NHL is its own animal. I mean, you know, it's a $5 billion industry. In the cases of a lot of leagues, they can't afford for whatever reason to push things deeper into the summer, or as deep into the summer as the NHL can. And I just, you know, everyone I've talked to from different leagues that have unfortunately had to cancel their seasons, from the ECHL to the Southern Professional Hockey League and others, just says, hey, look, you know, we do it if we can. We can't, but we believe that the NHL can because of just how much cash they have on hand. And again, how much money is on the line, too. I mean, the conservative estimate I got from somebody on the player side is that the playoffs are a $250 million revenue swing. And that's at a minimum, you know. So there's a lot of money on the line here for the league. And obviously when it comes to money, you're also talking about the player side of things and the fact that they don't want to have to, you know, pay exorbitant amounts of escrow for the next several years to make up for the revenue shortfall this year. So there's a lot of money on the line. There's a lot of money already in reserve, and there's obviously an appetite for both sides to get back on the ice if they can at some point in the next several months.
Greg Wyszynski of ESPN joins us here on 102.5 The Game. Greg, on Monday at The Athletic, we unveiled our NHL awards poll. We've been discussing, of course, the Norris Trophy vote, which was overwhelmingly won by Roman Josi. I know that you expressed surprise by the discrepancy in the voting margin between Roman Josi and John Carlson. When it comes down to the actual award vote, what do you think will happen? And do you think enough people around the league, particularly those of us in the Professional Hockey Writers Association, have seen enough of Roman Josi to give him a legitimate chance of winning the Norris Trophy over John Carlson?
Well, considering the Athletic hired everybody, I think, but me and Emily in the PGA.
That is true, yes. Yes.
I think this is a good indication that Roman Josi is going to win the Norris. Now, I was surprised by the gap. I think of the awards, it might have been the largest spread between first and second place, if only because Carlson's offensive year has been historic. I mean, you look back at the last, you know, 25 years of offensive seasons by defensemen, and Carlson's point per game average, I think, was the highest since like 1994, if the season was to cut off right now. And that's saying something. That's a special season. That's better than Brent Burns. It's better than Erik Karlsson. It's better than a lot of guys that have been lauded for their offensive output. I don't think his defense is as bad as people make it out to be, but it's clear that his reputation as an all-offense, no-defense guy has been cemented. And it kind of reminds me of what happened to Mike Green back in, like, 2009, I think it was, where he had 31 goals, an incredible offensive season for a defenseman, but it was, you know, a league-wide sentiment that this guy didn't have what it takes on the defensive side of the ice. I think the analytics showed that wasn't true, but that was the reputation. So the fact that Josi has this is clearly the second best offensive defenseman in the league this year, and also holds up his end of the bargain on the defensive side, probably tells me that he has the overall support to win the Norris, just because Carlson's defensive reputation can't match up to the incredible offensive season that he's had.
Greg, we've seen, you know, the league kind of taking retrospective look at series of years past. Like here locally, I know Fox Sports Tennessee is replaying Predators games. We're doing so as well here on ESPN 102 of the game. As you look back at your career, what's the favorite NHL event or NHL playoff series that you've ever covered, in your opinion?
Well, my favorite playoff series was the Boston-Vancouver series. I think it's the most monumental cup final we've had in decades. It wasn't the best hockey all the time, but as far as storylines go, it was like covering a soap opera every day. I mean, you go from just the general physical heat that those teams had, the fact that you had a Boston team that was an underdog against this Vancouver team that was really sort of reviled around the league, the Nathan Horton injury, the suspension to Aaron Rome, the rivalry between Tim Thomas and Roberto Luongo, the game where Brad Marchand is just rabbit punching a Sedin in front of the net without a penalty. And then, of course, you know, a series that goes all the way to a game seven, the Bruins win it on the road, and then Vancouver burns their city down. So, I mean, like, I just marvel at the fact that that series happened. And I do wonder, it happened at a time when Twitter was still sort of in its infancy. And I do wonder what would happen now that we have this sort of saturation of social media to have a series that contentious and that nasty and that newsworthy, what the reaction would have been now, because that thing was just incredible to cover.
Greg, last question for you. As a noted New Jersey Devils fan, I would like to ask you for what your reaction was to the owner of the team, Josh Harris, planning to reduce employee salaries by 20% and then having a major about face a few hours later after the public reaction of people when someone who is worth a few billion dollars at least decides to cut payroll. I'm just curious for your opinion on that whole situation.
Well, I think my opinion is that the Devils are owned by an ownership group that also owns the Philadelphia 76ers.
Right.
And the thing that we are seeing time and time again, now granted, there are some teams kind of testing the water right now in the NHL to figure out what the reaction will be if they, you know, lay off a bunch of people or if they cut salary. And this was sort of, you know, a trial balloon to that end for the Devils. But the more important side of things, and I think that we're seeing this time and time again with this ownership group when it comes to these two teams, is what's happening with the NBA side. And what happened on the NBA side is that Josh Harris came out and said, we're cutting, you know, salaries by 20%. And Joel Embiid stepped up and said, okay, well, I'm going to have to step up and pay the people that aren't being paid by this ownership group. And that embarrassed them. And so that's the backlash that happened. And we've seen it happen a few times in the NBA where players immediately stepped up to help out workers that were being impacted by the schedule shutdowns, and then the ownership stepped up. And so I don't know if it's a Devils fan or a Sixers fan or anybody that may have changed the opinion of this ownership group, but I sure know it's one of their star players that probably did, and then lo and behold, all of a sudden the course gets reversed. And the other thing about that too, like you said, Adam, is that he apologized for bad judgment. And, I mean, you know, in this day and age, to see a billionaire apologize or something was mind-blowing. So that was probably the most notable thing about the news yesterday.
Greg Wyshynski has been our guest from ESPN. Greg, thanks as always for taking the time to come on with us and continue to be safe with you and your family out there. I know it's a tough time for all of us.
Yeah, thanks for that. I also have something cool up today if you want to check it out. I asked 25 NHL players about their first line mates in the league, and it's a really cool story. Got some chuckles, got some heartfelt stuff. It's a good hockey read if you want to scratch your hockey itch today.
Yeah, definitely. I was looking at it over this morning, so I definitely recommend reading it if you're out there.
Awesome. Thanks, boys.
All right. Thanks, Greg. We appreciate it. Adam, when we come back, we'll wrap up the show. We'll get back into the Cam Newton stuff a little bit and also look ahead to what the Titans still have left to do in free agency and in the draft. That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Adam Vinken here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Final segment of the day here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Adam Vinken from The Athletic. And Adam, we got a text in on the text line that says, can you all research and touch on LeBron James getting sued for posting a picture of himself dunking. Just saw the story, but it doesn't really say much detail and thought y'all might have an insight. I looked that up, and basically what's happened is LeBron James posted a picture, or at least LeBron James's team posted a picture on social media of him dunking in a Lakers Heat game. I think he posted it on December the 14th, and he's dunking over Myers Leonard of the Heat. And basically he used a cropped version of that photograph. And Steve Mitchell, who's a photojournalist who's appeared in publications like Sports Illustrated and ESPN, he took that photo and has licensed it and is suing LeBron James for using that photo and cropping it on social media. So now I guess it's up to the Copyright Infringement Office in the U.S. District Court to determine whether or not James has to pay for using that photo that Steve Mitchell put up there. So kind of a crazy story, like a lot of things going on in the world of sports right now, but Steve Mitchell apparently suing LeBron James for using one of his photos.
This is from Sports Illustrated Michael McCann, who does a great job of covering the law, in the sports law. He says, quote, "The fact that James is featured prominently in Mitchell's photo did not give James the right to publish it elsewhere. Mitchell owns his photos. This goes to the essence of copyright law. Absent a contractual relationship that instructs otherwise, Mitchell possesses copyrights in his creative works, including his photos. As a result, Mitchell has the right to control the reproduction of his photos, such as their publication on social media websites. Furthermore, as a credentialed photojournalist and consistent with NBA media policies, Mitchell has permission to take photos during NBA games so long as the photos are for news coverage of those games. Those who interfere with Michael's copyrights are potentially liable for infringement." And it goes on to say that he went a step further in protecting his rights by registering the photo with the U.S. Copyright Office, which I think has led to the lawsuit.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, like at the end of the day, I guess not a huge deal for LeBron James getting sued here, but certainly, you know, one of those things now where we see it a lot on social media where people like use pictures that maybe in articles, maybe in social media posts that they have, that they didn't take and really don't have permission to use. And it's kind of interesting, the world that we live in right now, LeBron James experiencing that firsthand.
And what's interesting is, as Michael McCann points out, that if this lawsuit does indeed continue, that LeBron James and his lawyers will likely use fair use as a defense, and that means this defense would assert that while Mitchell may be the rightful owner of the original photo, James' publication of a cropped version was permissible. Fair use can be established when use of a copyright work is intended for news reporting, teaching, criticism, comment, or one of several other limited purposes. So I have a feeling that this is going to probably be thrown out, or LeBron James will make a nice little we'll offer Mitchell a settlement, yeah, by saying that was a great photo, but it's also a settlement.
I'm going to frame it.
But also a settlement, and LeBron James isn't hurting for cash, so I think he'll be okay.
I think he'll be okay, too. Adam, we had Greg Wyshynski on in our last segment, and we were just kind of talking about the Norris Trophy race that Roman Yossi finds himself in now. We talked earlier in the show about kind of the wide margin of victory he had in the Athletic poll that featured 41 riders. You know, after hearing Greg, I think there's at least a decent chance that Roman Yossi is going to win the Norris Trophy this year if the NHL season does not resume and the regular season just kind of ends where it's ended at this point.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the show, where I think that the pausing of the season might actually work to John Carlson's advantage, because I think if the season would have continued as planned and the Predators would have made the playoffs, and let's just say Roman Yossi had a great final 13 regular season games, I think that may have cemented Yossi in the eyes of the voters. But because the season ended, there are a lot of unknowns. But one thing you do know, as Greg mentioned, is that Carlson had 75 points. He was on pace for 89. It's been since 1994 that a defenseman had at least 89 points in the season, and that actually might work to Carlson's benefit. So I'm not convinced yet that there will be enough support for Roman Yossi, despite our Athletic poll, to win the Norris Trophy. But I think either way, whether it's Yossi winning or Carlson winning, because I think we can both agree that it's going to be one of them to win it, it's going to be incredibly close.
We had David Newton on earlier in the show talking about the Cam Newton situation. David Newton, of course, covers the Carolina Panthers for ESPN. And one thing he brought up during that conversation was the running back position. And obviously that's a popular topic of conversation around here with Titans fans and Derrick Henry having the franchise tag placed on him. But he was talking about Christian McCaffrey. Like, if there's an example of a running back in the NFL right now that can do everything, I think Christian McCaffrey by far is the perfect example of that. I would even toss in Alvin Kamara in that example as well. But even David Newton was talking about, you know, the Panthers are going to negotiate with Christian McCaffrey. In all likelihood, he's going to get another deal, another big deal. But I think they also know that there's a certain point that the Panthers are not going to be willing to go to because of the position that he's played, because of the wear and tear he's had on his body and the usage he's had in the last couple of years. And, you know, if you're having that conversation with Christian McCaffrey and all the production he's had and all the different things he can do out of the backfield, that just kind of shows you a sign of the times right now of what Derrick Henry and other running backs around the league are dealing with when they're trying to negotiate for some of these longer-term contracts.
Yeah, if Christian McCaffrey might have a hard time convincing a team to give him a lot of money, then no other running back in the league is going to be able to do it. And we've talked about this a lot. Derrick Henry had a fantastic season last year, was perhaps the reason why the Tennessee Titans got to the AFC Championship game, especially when you consider his performance in the two playoff games against the Patriots and Baltimore Ravens. But, you know, Christian McCaffrey, to me, is the most dynamic player in the backfield in the NFL. I mean, David was talking about how the Panthers, maybe four wins would be considered generous for them this upcoming season. But without Christian McCaffrey, it might be one, maybe even zero, just because of how spectacular he is at doing everything. So if he can't get paid, Derrick Henry's going to have a hard time convincing the Titans to give him big money, too.
Quickly, before we wrap up here, we got a text in on the text line that says, if a photographer takes a picture of a person, does that person not have the rights to the photo? I believe that he should. That, of course, referring to the conversation we had to start this segment about LeBron James being sued by a photographer who took a picture of him and LeBron used it on social media. That is a good point. Like, if you're a photographer, and I get it, you know, it's your work that you're doing, and certainly there's something to that, and you want to license that and get paid for the work that you've done. But he's also taking a picture of LeBron James. So he is using his picture of LeBron James to make money for himself. I feel like if I'm LeBron James, if somebody's taking a picture of me, maybe I would feel the right to be able to use that photo.
And another argument in this SI story we were talking about, James's attorneys could also point out that the Facebook photo is clearly altered from Mitchell's photo. The cropped version amplifies the appearance of James with Leonard and JaVale McGee also visible. The original photo, in contrast, displays a much wider and higher view. One could argue that the Facebook version is all about James's dunk, whereas the original version is more about the scene in which James dunked. Now we're getting into semantics, but I mean, that's a good point. You know, certainly, you know, the photographer seems to have a case, especially if he had the wherewithal to get the photo copyrighted or took the extra step to protect his self-interest.
Yeah, no question. So going to be interesting to see how that plays out with LeBron James and the copyright infringement lawsuit that apparently has come against him. So thanks to you all for bringing that to our attention. I had not seen that in the world of sports, which you figure, with LeBron being involved in the center of it, would have been all over the place.
We are living in uncertain times. Not even LeBron James can save us from those.
You're exactly right. Adam, thanks so much for joining me on the show today, man. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, my friend.
Absolutely. Adam Vingan from The Athletic, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back tomorrow here on Morning Drive from 6 to 10. Darren, Donick, and Chase coming up next. This is ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.